welcome to Poly Am I. I am your host, Polyamorous Jay. Today's episode is the third and final episode in a three-part series in which we will conclude our discussion on the forms of polyamory. During the first episode in this series, we discussed group relationships, kitchen table polyamory, parallel polyamory, and solo polyamory. Then, for the second episode in this series, we discussed monopoly relationships and hierarchy, as well as the difference between having an open or closed relationship. Today, we will begin with a brief discussion of what the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy is, and then dive into the different types of polyamorous partnerships. To start us off, let's look at what Don't Ask, Don't Tell is. Don't Ask, Don't Tell is a policy, or agreement, made within a partnership that states that one or both parties do not wish to hear anything about their partner's other partners. They won't ask about them, and they don't want their partner to tell them anything about them. This is usually enacted as a way to avoid jealousy, but has a tendency to backfire and cause even more issues. Don't ask, don't tell, on the whole, is secretive in nature, as the main purpose is to not share information with your partner. For the most part, this directly goes against the polyamorous community's focus on open communication amongst all partners. Within polyamory, you need to be able to discuss things honestly and openly in order to not only ensure consent, but also to maintain a healthy dynamic and keep up to date on everyone's wants, needs, and boundaries. When you are in a don't ask, don't tell relationship, those important key pieces can be missing. How can you know if your partner is or isn't truly okay with something if you can't discuss it with them first? Issues can also arise when confronted with new partnerships. It can be an odd thing for potential partners to be told they aren't allowed to speak to or perhaps even know about your other partner or partners. It can come off as someone trying to hide the fact that they are actually just cheating on their partner. Who's to say their partner really is accepting of this polyamorous dynamic if you can't confirm it with them directly? There's a lot to say for being able to see or speak to your metamors, and at least know where they're at. Getting into a relationship with someone who has a don't ask, don't tell agreement with their other partners is often a risk a lot of us polyamorous folks just aren't willing to take. Another problem new partners run into when dating someone who uses don't ask, don't tell is that they often have to act as if they don't know the person they are involved with, or at least act as if they aren't dating when they are out in public or around that person's other partner. If you see them and their partner somewhere, you can't run up and say hi or give them a kiss or maybe anything at all, because their partner is unaware that you exist romantically or sexually in their partner's life. This can feel really isolating for the partner outside of the don't ask, don't tell agreement. They may often feel ignored or disregarded. This can also happen when their partner isn't allowed to text them or call them, or engage in any sort of way when around their other partner. It may be near to impossible to get a hold of them if they live with their other partner, especially if the two of them spend tons of time together. Of course, the reason for the don't ask, don't tell policy in the first place is typically because a couple is new to non-monogamy, though this isn't always the case, as some more seasoned polyamorous individuals still may use don't ask, don't tell. However, when you're just starting out, though it may seem exciting to open up your relationship, the reality of your partner dating others can sometimes also seem scary. To curb any negative feelings, a don't ask, don't tell agreement may be set in place. The thinking being, if you don't hear about it, then you can't be jealous about it, and it can't cause problems. But when things do come into view, and almost certainly they will, finding out your partner is involved seriously in committed relationships that you don't know anything about can seem catastrophic in comparison to learning about a relationship as it is just starting to grow and develop. And by that point, you have missed all your chances to discuss your feelings about any of it. It is all just thrown at you all at once. things tend to blow up unnecessarily when this happens. And it all could have been avoided by being open from the get-go. I highly, highly, highly recommend spending the time necessary to work through jealousy and any other complicated emotions as they come along, instead of trying to avoid them. Now that I've stressed open, honest communication, let's discuss the types of polyamorous partnerships that can be formed or may naturally develop. First off, we've got primary, secondary, and tertiary, which are typically labels used within hierarchical dynamics. Then we have things such as nesting partner, anchor partner, and comet. There are a plethora of other labels out there as well, but these are the ones we will be discussing today. When it comes to the primary, secondary, and tertiary labels, they can be used in any number of ways, tertiary being the least common label. Typically, those using hierarchy use the terms primary and secondary to describe the degree of entanglement within one of three categories: emotional involvement, logistical involvement, or ground rules within the relationship. Now, emotional involvement refers to the intensity or depth of the person's feelings for their partner. Then you have the logistical involvement, which refers to living and financial arrangements, co-parenting, etc. And then finally, you have the ground rules, which refers to the agreement that a particular relationship involves a certain level of maintenance, and thus must take priority. There are also two separate usages of these labels. Under the class of relationship usage, relationships are based on the extent of what that relationship entails. This leaves room for people to have multiple primary partners and multiple secondary partners, sometimes only secondary partners. Under the ranking usage, things are stricter, and you can usually only have one primary, one secondary, and so on. However, some polyamorous individuals may use a combination of the two usages. For example, defining their largest involvement as primary by rank, while lumping all others as secondary by class. Both forms of labeling are acceptable, as long as those involved are consenting of those labels. The main issue here is the difference between using the labels descriptively or prescriptively. Descriptive use being simply explaining the extent of what your relationship entails by using the primary and secondary terminology. The fact that you raise children together or spend so much time together makes them your primary. Opposed to using prescriptive labels, in which you are defining what a relationship has to be because of its status, such as saying that because you're in a primary relationship with one partner, that means that you have to put them first. This second form excuses the fact that relationships ebb and flow. It dictates what must happen instead of allowing flexibility for what could happen. Most often, when the polyamorous community gets into arguments about the ethics of hierarchy, they are mainly disagreeing with using labels prescriptively. Now, the term tertiary isn't used very often, but since it's considered part of the hierarchy labeling, I'll briefly explain it. At its simplest, tertiary can mean a relationship that is a level lower than secondary. Other times, it means specifically that the partners only see each other sporadically. It can be a one-time thing or highly erratic, but generally means that the partner isn't a regular or consistent part of your life. Again, using this term, as with the others, in a prescriptive nature opposed to a descriptive one, can make things messy. Okay, that was a lot. Let's move on. The next three labels we will discuss are fairly simple and somewhat self-explanatory. Nesting partner, for example, simply means someone you are living or nesting with. Sometimes this partnership involves marriage or children, but it doesn't have to. It literally just means you are sharing a nest or living space. They are the partner you wake up to in the morning and come home to at the end of the day. Not every polyamorous person has a nesting partner, but it is one of the most common types of partnership. Sometimes nesting partner is used to replace the term primary partner in order to negate hierarchical labels, although it can only be used in circumstances where the partners live together, as all other primaries would not be considered nesting together. Next, we have anchor partner. This term is basically the same thing as primary or nesting partner, as it implies that you're in a very logistically entangled relationship. It's often used as a non-hierarchical form of the term primary, and can be used for all primaries, as it does not require that the partners live together, as does the term nesting partner. However, it can also be used in a slightly different manner, as describing a partnership that is steady and tethers you, or grounds you like an anchor. In this form, it does not necessarily need to be someone with which you are largely entangled in any form. Of course, the usage is at your discretion, but will most often be more greatly understood as similar to primary. Lastly, let's cover what a comet partner is. A comet partner is someone who comes in and out of your life. They are not a continuous partner. You may or may not communicate with them while they are away, but things are typically amazing and intense when they come around. This is different than having a long-distance relationship where you see your partner rarely because of the distance, but keep in frequent contact and consider each other continuous partners. A comet partner may only be your partner during the time in which they are with you, and then you may not see them or even speak to them for a long period of time. This can be a healthy or unhealthy dynamic, depending on whether it disrupts your life drastically each time they show up. And that's it for today. As you can tell from everything we've discussed in this series, there is a lot that goes into determining someone's form of polyamory. When you hear people in the polyamorous community say, "Everyone does polyamory differently," it is easy to see what they mean because there are just so many different options out there. Whether referring to the type of polyamory you practice, the agreements you make within your relationships, or the types of partnerships you engage in, there are a plethora of dynamics to choose from. No matter who you are or what you're looking for, there is something out there for you. So, you do you, and I'll do me. Because everyone does polyamory differently. That brings us to the end of part 3, the last part in our 3-part series. If you have any questions you'd like us to answer on our podcast, please email them to johnny@polyamorousliving.com. That's JAUNI@polyamorousliving.com. Or leave us a voice message. For our next episode, we will be discussing the misconceptions about polyamory. Till next time, this has been Polyamorous J on Polyamory, discussing the forms of polyamory. Have a gay day. Ciao.